This is Telling Tales with Ms. G here at KTOO 104.3 in Juneau. And I have a nice little story for you tonight. It's by Edgar Keret, and it's translated from the Hebrew by Sandra Silverston. The title is Creative Writing. I'll give you a moment to get settled, and I will be right back with Telling Tales with Ms. G here at 104.3 KTOO in Juneau, Alaska. And this is Ms. G. I'm back with Telling Tales here at 104.3 KTOO in Juneau, Alaska. Tonight's story is titled Creative Writing by Edgar Keret. It is translated from the Hebrew by Sandra Silverston. The first story Maya wrote was about a world in which people split themselves in two instead of reproducing. In that world, every person could, at any given moment, turn into two beings, each one half his or her age. Some chose to do this when they were young. For instance, an 18-year-old might split into 2 9-year-olds. Others would wait until they'd established themselves professionally and financially and go for it only in middle age. The heroine of Maya's story was splitless. She had reached the age of 80. And despite constant social pressure, insisted on not splitting. At the end of the story, she died. It was a good story, except for the ending. There was something depressing about that part, Aviad thought. Depressing and predictable. But Maya, in the writing workshop she had signed up for, actually got a lot of compliments on the ending. The instructor, who was supposed to be this well-known writer, even though Aviad had never heard of him, told her that there was something soul-piercing about the banality of the ending, or some other piece of crap. Aviad saw how happy that compliment made Maya. She was very excited when she told him about it. She recited what the writer had said to her the way people recite a verse from the Bible. And Aviad, who had originally tried to suggest a different ending, backpedaled and said, it was all a matter of taste, and that he really didn't understand much about it. It had been her mother's idea that she go to a creative writing workshop. She'd said that a friend's daughter had attended one and enjoyed it very much. Aviad also thought it would be good for Maya to get out of more, to do something with herself. He could always bury himself in work, but since the miscarriage, she never left the house. Whenever he came home, he found her in the living room, sitting up straight on the couch, not reading, not watching TV, not even crying. When Maya hesitated about the course, Aviad knew how to persuade her. Go once, give it a try, he said, the way a kid goes to day camp. Later, he realized that it had been a little insensitive of him to use a child as an example, after what they'd been through 2 months before. But Maya actually smiled and said that day camp might be just what she needed. The second story she wrote was about a world in which you could see only the people you loved. The protagonist was a married man in love with his wife. One day, his wife walked right into him in the hallway, and the glass he was holding fell and shattered on the floor. A few days later, she sat down on him as he was dozing in an armchair. Both times, she wriggled out of it with an excuse. She'd had something else on her mind. She hadn't been looking when she sat down. But the husband started to suspect that she didn't love him anymore. To test his theory, he decided to do something drastic. He shaved off the left side of his mustache. He came home with half a mustache, clutching a bouquet of anemones. His wife thanked him for the flowers and smiled. He could sense her groping the air as she tried to give him a kiss. Maya called the story Half a Mustache and told Avia that when she'd read it aloud in the workshop, some people had cried. Avia said, "Wow," and kissed her on the forehead. That night, they fought about some stupid little thing. She'd forgotten to pass on a message or something like that, and he yelled at her. He was to blame, and in the end, he apologized. "I had a hellish day at work," he said and stroked her leg, trying to make up for his outburst. "Do you forgive me?" She forgave him. The workshop instructor had published a novel and a collection of short stories. Neither had been much of a success, but they'd had a few good reviews. At least, that's what the saleswoman at a bookstore near Aviad's office told him. The novel was very thick, 624 pages. Aviad bought the book of short stories. He kept it in his desk and tried to read a little during lunch breaks. Each story in the collection took place in a different foreign country. It was kind of a gimmick. The blurb on the back cover said that the writer had worked for years as a tour guide in Cuba and Africa, and that his travels had influenced his writing. There was also a small black-and-white photograph of him. In it, he had the kind of smug smile of someone who feels lucky to be who he is. The writer had told Maya, she said to Aviad, that when the workshop was over, he'd send her stories to his editor. And although she shouldn't get her hopes up, publishers these days were desperate for new talent. Her third story started out funny. It was about a woman who gave birth to a cat. The hero of the story was the husband, who suspected that the cat wasn't his, a fat ginger tomcat that slept on the lid of the dumpster right below the window of the couple's bedroom, gave the husband a condescending look every time he went downstairs to throw out the garbage. In the end, there was a violent clash between the husband and the cat. The husband threw a stone at the cat, which countered with bites and scratches. The injured husband, his wife, and the kitten she was breastfeeding went to the clinic for him to get a rabies shot. He was humiliated and in pain, but tried not to cry while they were waiting. The kitten, sensing his suffering, uncurled itself from its mother's embrace, went over to him, and licked his face tenderly, offering a consoling meow. "Did you hear that?" the mother asked emotionally. He said, "Daddy." At that point, the husband could no longer hold back his tears, and when Aviad read that passage, he had to try hard not to cry too. Maya said that she started writing the story even before she knew she was pregnant again. "Isn't it weird?" she asked, "how my brain didn't know yet, but my subconscious did?" The next Tuesday, when Aviad was supposed to pick her up after the workshop, he arrived half an hour early, parked his car in the lot, and went to find her. Maya was surprised to see him in the classroom, and he insisted that she introduce him to the writer. The writer reeked of body lotion. He shook Aviad's hand limply and told him that if Maya had chosen him for a husband, he must be a very special person. 3 weeks later, Aviad signed up for a beginner's creative writing class. He didn't say anything about it to Maya, and to be on the safe side, he told his secretary that if he had any calls from home, she should say that he was in an important meeting and couldn't be disturbed. The other members of the class were mostly elderly women who gave him dirty looks. The thin young instructor wore a headscarf, and the women in the class gossiped about her, saying that she lived in a settlement in the occupied territories and had cancer. She asked everyone to do an exercise in automatic writing. "Write whatever comes into your head," she said. "Don't think, just write." Aviad tried to stop thinking. It was very hard. The old women around him wrote with nervous speed, like students racing to finish an exam before the teacher tells them to put their pens down. And after a few minutes, he began writing too. The story he wrote was about a fish that was swimming happily along in the sea when a wicked witch turned it into a man. The fish couldn't come to terms with the transformation and decided to chase down the wicked witch and make her turn him back into a fish. Since he was an especially quick and enterprising fish, he managed to get married while he was pursuing her, and even to establish a small company that imported plastic products from the Far East. With the help of the enormous knowledge he had gained as a fish who had crossed the seven seas, the company began to thrive and even went public. Meanwhile, the Wicked Witch, who was a little tired after all her years of wickedness, decided to find all the people and creatures she'd cast spells on, apologize to them, and restore them to their natural state. At one point, she even went to see the fish she had turned into a man. The fish's secretary asked her to wait until he'd finished a satellite meeting with his partners in Taiwan. At that stage in his life, the fish could hardly remember that he was, in fact, a fish, and his company now controlled half the world. The witch waited several hours, but when she saw the meeting wouldn't be ending anytime soon, she climbed onto her broom and flew off. The fish kept doing better and better until one day, when he was really old, he looked out the window of one of the dozens of huge shoreline buildings he'd purchased in a smart real estate deal and saw the sea. And suddenly he remembered that he was a fish. A very rich fish who controlled many subsidiary companies that were traded on stock markets around the world. But still, a fish. A fish who, for years, had not tasted the salt of the sea. When the instructor saw that Aviad had put down his pen, she gave him an inquiring look. "I don't have an ending," he whispered apologetically, keeping his voice down so as not to disturb the old ladies who were still writing. I hope you enjoyed that story. That was Creative Writing by Edgar Carret, and it was translated from the Hebrew by Sandra Silverston. This is Telling Tales with Ms. G at KTO 104.3 in Juneau, Alaska. I'll be right back. This is Ms. G bringing you Telling Tales here at 104.3 and KTO in Juneau. I hope you enjoyed that last story. That was very fun to read. My next story is The Westernization of Mrs. Jones by Crystal Arbogast. The smell of popcorn strayed into the bedroom, targeting my nostrils as I relaxed on fluffed-up pillows, flicking through TV channels. As usual, over 25 stations on cable, and I end up with the same thing at this time, a rerun of MASH. My husband entered with our nightly snack and grabbed from one of his pillows, which I had snatched earlier. Seeing my reluctance at moving, he said, "Come on, give it up. If you need another pillow, go buy one." As he settled himself on the other side of the bed, I mumbled something in reference to kings and their castles. This prompted a reply. "While you're on that subject, guess who I got a letter from today?" "Who?" I asked. I could see that he really wanted me to be held in suspense for a while. It was the way he slowly chewed his popcorn. Then he tossed another kernel into the air, trying to catch it in his open mouth. Well, I said, while attempting to beat some air into my flattened pillows, I haven't the faintiest, and I really don't feel like guessing. So if you're going to tell me, then tell me. Ken Jones, came the reply. Ken Jones. It's amazing how a name can awaken sleeping memories. Really? Did he mention Rosita? I mean, are they still together? Sure. An envelope was tossed onto my stomach, and I looked at the return address. There isn't a base around this city, is there? Nope. He's out. Really? I took him for a lifer. I mean, he really didn't seem to be suited for anything else but the military. So what's he doing now? Read the letter. I think you'll be surprised. A kiss landed on my forehead, the usual goodnight signal. I picked up the letter, and my thoughts wandered back to 15 years before. My husband had been an airman and was assigned to a base in Germany during his last year of duty. He lived in a village outside Wiesbaden. The apartment we rented was small and cramped, but we were together. That is, except for the weeks and sometimes months which he spent on the road. Communications squadrons were always on the move, especially those based in Central Europe. As a result of being left alone frequently, American wives had to adapt quickly and learn how to manage on their own in a foreign economy. A camaraderie had developed between the wives in our building, and when Ken Jones moved in, a conspiracy developed. Ken had latched onto my husband in basic training. He had been one of the more colorful characters in the many boot camp stories I had been subjected to. I had made up my mind that I had not missed much. This decision became concrete after I actually met him. I remember the day he had shown up at the apartment. Rick, old buddy, after a few good-natured macho slaps, I was introduced. Ken, this is my wife, Stacy. Glad to meet you, Stace. Gee, bud, I bet you kind of get nervous leaving a good-looking thing like that all alone, huh? As Ken surveyed my body, revulsion led my retreat into our kitchenette, where I politely excused myself. While I cleaned up a few glasses and made coffee, Ken's voice trailed in from the front room. Yep, I picked me up a little babe while I was in the Philippines. Works like a dog, keeps her mouth shut, and let me tell you something else. All those things they say about Asian women and sex, it's true. I'll tell you, old buddy, she can... Ken, that's okay. Spare me the details. I had detected the uneasiness in Rick's voice. Why don't you bring your wife up to dinner tonight? Our wives can get to know each other. Stacy's been here long enough to make her way around. She can help your wife out while we're on the road. Later on, Ken was again at our door. A small, doll-like girl with long black hair was at his side. I took an instant liking to her, a feeling quite opposite to which I held for her husband. She did not speak much at all during the meal, but had seemed eager to help me with the dishes. Alone in the kitchenette, I had done most of the talking. I was able, however, to learn a little about her family. It became obvious that they were very poor and that she missed them. The guys were sent to Holland the next week. Ken came up to the apartment early the morning of their departure. Hey, Stace, I wanted to ask a favor of you. I felt naked as his eyes found my chest and stayed there. I was wondering, he continued, if you would mind picking up our mail and maybe some groceries while I'm gone. Rick says that you make a couple of trips a week to the base. Sure, Ken. I'll be glad to show Rosita around. The girl's an... Oh, no. See, Rosita's kind of timid, and while she's not exactly a liberated woman, know what I mean? My eyes immediately glared back into his smug grin. No, I don't know what you mean, Ken. What does learning to get around and pick up your mail have to do with being liberated? And why do you say liberated the way you do? Rick had picked up his bags and hurried to the door. I'm sure Stacy won't mind. His eyes pleaded with me as he spoke. I'll be down in a minute, Ken. The familiar grin spread across his face. Sure, old buddy. I'll be waiting downstairs. Don't be too long. I took care of my woman last night. As Ken stomped down the stairway, Rick closed the door. Rick, I hate him. I absolutely loathe him. Before I could say another word, Rick kissed me. Realizing that he was leaving again, I forgot about the swamp creature and hung on to my husband. That same day, I had made up my mind that I would ignore Ken's request. I took Rosita into town and onto the base. I taught her how to buy the bus tickets and how to stamp them once she boarded. I was amazed at her enthusiasm. She began to talk more and smile more. When the housemeister made his weekly visit to that building, I informed Rosita that it was his job to inspect the furnace and sweep down the stairs. He never succeeded in sweeping down our stairway, so the women did the job. He clanged and banged away in the furnace room as if he were accomplishing something. Then he would beg for cigaretten. I told Rosita to avoid him. All of the women in the building eventually adopted Ken's quiet wife. She seemed surprised that the majority of us were continuing our education on base. Janie Scott, who lived on the third floor, was a law student. She amazed Rosita with the facts on divorce. I personally suspect she did this on purpose. She had met Ken also. Sue from across the hall majored in business. She was also near to giving birth to her second child. It was Sue who pushed Rosita toward the idea of going to school. One morning, as we made our way to the bus stop, a strange sight emerged from one of the neighboring apartment buildings. A small, round woman, dressed in a house coat and house slippers, stepped out onto the sidewalk. She was leading a straggly, mixed-breed pup by a tattered rope, which was tied around his neck. The rope, however, was caught up and around the dog's hind leg. This caused the animal to hop along on three legs. The woman trailing behind him seemed oblivious to the situation. A big smile spread across her face when she saw Rosita and myself. As we moved closer, she started a conversation. "Hello, me Kim. I live here, where you live." As I pointed in the direction of my apartment building, she continued, "Your husband's Air Force." As we nodded our heads, she said, "My husband's Army. No good GI. You come over sometime. I teach you cook Korean." Rosita visited Kim a few times a week. After a while, my friends and I noticed a kind of slang appearing in Rosita's speech. It was kind of cute. She also had begun to talk more freely as time went by. She enjoyed our company, but she was especially close to Kim. "Kim say American men like to treat their Asian women like something in movie," she had said to me one day in the downstairs laundry room. "Really?" "Yeah, but she say we come a long way, baby." I had laughed at that remark and said, "Do you intend to take up smoking also?" Unfamiliar with the cigarette commercial, she was visually puzzled by my question. "Never mind," I had said. "So what do you plan to do, Rosita?" "I go to school. I want to make big money someday." "That's good. But what will Ken say? Doesn't he want to start a family?" "Ken, good man," she had said. "I give him babies, but I get what I want. Never be poor again. Help my family." We had 6 weeks with Rosita. When the men returned home, Ken had not noticed the change in his wife at first. Then one evening, Ken appeared at our door again. I eavesdropped to bits and pieces of the conversation while he visited with Rick. "She's been gone all day. She mumbled something this morning about going to the base school or something. She walks in after 6. When I ask her about supper, she shoves a beer at my face and tells me to relax. Then she tells me that I'm acting like a no-good GI. Where'd she get that stuff?" The vision of Kim and her housecoat came to my mind, and I had to stifle a giggle. I had always wondered about the outcome of that year and the result of our influence on Rosita. When Rick's tour of duty was over, I said goodbye to my comrades. I still correspond with Janie and Sue. I lost track of everyone else, although I still consider them my friends. I admit I had worried about our pupil for a while. Then she began to fade away into the gray fog of forgetfulness as we got on to our own lives. I opened the envelope. I was surprised to read about the 4 kids, 3 girls, and a boy. Oh, well, maybe he won't turn out like his dad. Then I smiled as I read on. "Well, old buddy, I've got to go. Rosita's got her own business, and she gets home late. I've got to get some supper on. It's my turn tonight." Still smiling, I folded the letter and placed it on the night table. As my husband snored softly, I reached for the remote, pausing as a late-night commercial caught my eye. 6 Asian babes, as Ken would have called them, all lined up for inspection. Hello, would you like to correspond with beautiful single Filipino girls? There are many beautiful girls waiting just for you. That was The Westernization of Mrs. Jones by Crystal Arbogast. This is Telling Tales with Ms. G. Here at 104.3 in Juneau, Alaska. I hope you enjoyed that story. I'll be right back. Stay tuned. This is Ms. G. I'm still bringing you Telling Tales here tonight at 104.3 in Juneau. And I have a few minutes on the clock, so I thought I'd read you this poem by Jody A. Shapiro. It's titled, Imagine When the Wind Comes Falling into the Arms of the Great Mother. Imagine the wind ripping you from the pier to which you'd lashed yourself and in the arcing out. And then the terrifying drop, you are embraced. Great arms catch you, great surety secures you, held without crushing, fast without sticking, whole without illusion, found more clearly than ever you had believed yourself lost. Imagine, behold, behold with the eyes the old one saw with, and the priestesses by the wells of her love, and every singer, every poet, every midwife, every charioteer, pounding through the gates and across the finish line, exulting, knowing where the beginning and the ending are, and that unspeakably and bright they are the same. This is what holds you. This is that which catches you, sets your heart beating and frees you when your time in the cage of your bones is done, and welcomes you home again and again. Here is where she lives. Let go, lift up, pour forth, for you are, dearly and without exception, hailed. That was Imagine When the Wind Comes, Falling into the Arms of the Great Mother by Jody A. Shapiro. This has been Telling Tales with Ms. G here at 104.3 in Juneau, Alaska. I hope you enjoyed stories tonight. Until next time, good night.